Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events here in central Iowa. I am your host today, Cynthia McClure, along with my co-host, Tom Beal. Today, we are featuring a story about the climate change hub here in Ames, Iowa.
And that hub is headed by Dr. Jerry Hatfield. Let me tell you a little about him. He received his PhD from Iowa State University in 1975 in the area of agricultural climatology and statistics. Then he received an MS in agronomy from the University of Kentucky and a BS from Kansas State University in agronomy in 1971. He served on the faculty of the University of California, Davis as a biometeorologist from 1975 through 1983 and then joined the USDA Agricultural Research Service in Lubbock, Texas as the research leader of the Plant Stress and Water Conservation Research Unit. He was there from 1983 through 1989. He was appointed laboratory director of the National Soil Tilth Laboratory here in Ames in 1989, and that facility has since been renamed the Laboratory for Agriculture and the Environment in October of 2009. Now, his career and his background go on at some length. I wanted to touch, though, on one important aspect, which we might be able to explore a little later in our discussion this morning. He was part of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, nicknamed IPCC, a process that received a 2007 Nobel Peace Prize, and he currently serves on the IPCC Special Committee to evaluate the impact of extreme events on ecosystems. As we look out the window of our studios here in downtown Ames, we see a beautiful little snowfall and an indication of the interesting climate changes that are taking place, although, of course, snow in February in Ames is not unusual. Let me, we're going to talk with Dr. Hatfield here in a moment, but first let's do a quick recap of the weather. It says here that snow is likely, and I believe we can confirm that, folks, if you look out the window.
Yeah, I got this off weather.gov, so this is accurate.
Well, it is, and it will be snowy and cloudy through mid-morning, and then we'll have gradual clearing. We'll have a high today of about 18. Wind chill values as low as zero, however. North-northwest wind 10 to 15 miles per hour with gusts as high as 21 miles per hour. Should blow some of that snow around in our faces. A chance of precipitation, 70%. Today, daytime snow accumulation of less than half an inch possible. But I think if you go out there with a ruler, you're going to see it's more than half an inch, maybe even a couple inches.
Yeah, I dusted a couple inches off my car, so yeah, I can vouch for that.
We'll
drive
have
safe, folks.
Clouds tonight with a low around 4. Wind chill values as low as minus 5. North-northwest wind 8 to 13 miles per hour, becoming light and variable. On Saturday, snow again is likely, mainly before noon. It will be mostly cloudy with a high near 29. Wind chill values as low as minus 10. Don't put your long underwear away yet. South-southeast wind 8 to 15 miles per hour becoming southwest in the afternoon. And winds could gust as high as 21 miles per hour. We'll have a 70% chance of precipitation on Saturday. And we could get another 1 to 2 inches of snow. Now, Saturday night, it'll be mostly cloudy, a low around 14, wind chill values as low as 5. West-southwest wind 6 to 11 miles per hour, becoming north after midnight. And then Sunday, mostly cloudy with a high near 30. North wind 5 to 13 miles per hour, becoming southeast in the afternoon. And Saturday night, a slight chance of freezing rain before midnight, then a slight chance of sleet. Oh, that sounds so lovely. Cloudy with a low around 24 with a chance of precipitation.
That would be Sunday night, Tom.
About 20%. Oh, Sunday night, that's true. We'll have a little time to get ready for that.
Yeah, this is Groundhog Day for a while, folks. It looks like we are have snow for a little while. So,
That's the weather for
now. I have Dr. Hatfield here in the studio, and I also have a gentleman, a farmer, and he will be, because I thought...
Well, he's not in the studio.
I thought it was important. No, he's not in the studio. His name is George Naylor. He's been farming 30 years, and he's a third-generation farmer of corn and soybean. I just wanted to get the perspective from the farmers here in central Iowa, so he is representing all y'all. And so his accumulated knowledge and wisdom will be directed at the good doctor here to ask questions that are pertinent about this climate change hub. And anyway, Dr. Hatfield, do you have anything to say? Because climate change, there's been a lot of movies about it and a lot of crazy stories going on the news. What can we actually expect from climate change?
Well, I think one of the major misperceptions about climate change, and because you think back, we called it global warming for a while, and I think people get in the idea that when we talk about climate change, that everything is going to change in this nice uniform pattern as we go forward. Everything is, it's going to warm, it'll be a little bit warmer climate and everything else. But in reality, think about climate schizophrenia. and you look at back, and I'll just go back to the summer of 2013, because we had one of the wettest periods in early spring, and we had one of the driest late summers in there, and we had basically two extremes all in one growing season. And if we look forward as we think about this, climate is probably going to become more variable. And what I tell producers in thinking about the impact of weather within their growing season and what they need to plan for is that they're probably in for a fairly wild ride in terms of just the variation of weather and how that's going to impact their agricultural systems, how they're going to have to plan for that in maybe different ways and make different management decisions along the way.
So these variable weather patterns are going to they're going to take their toll cost wise because if they plant too early or plant too late, there's no predictability, is what you're saying.
The predictability is going to become a lot more problematic. Everybody, let's put it this way. Everybody says, you know, we can't predict the weather anyway, and now I'm going to tell you that we're probably going to be even on the fringes of being able to predict that. And so one of the things that the climate hubs that come back to what they're really trying to work on is, what do we know from a science-based information?
So these are measurable facts. This is not a conjecture. These are measurable facts.
These are measurable facts. And, in fact, a lot of this is based on what we've done in science. How do we understand some of these relationships? And then how can we put that into information through extension, through education efforts to help producers prepare for this? I mean, and I'll just give you one example as a short little piece of this is, if we knew the summer was going to be really dry towards the end of the season, would producers be better off thinking about shorter season hybrids on corn that would mature a little early in the season before they really ran out of water? But for farmers to make that decision, we're going to have to increase the probability of us being right. Okay, I'll put that out there. And then how do we bring all this together? So these climate hubs are going to pull a lot of information from a lot of different groups, put it into our best understanding of these processes to be able to help people make better decisions about where weather and climate can really impact their operations.
So how do farmers access this?
That's going to be the piece that we're building right now. And I think we're going to see an entirely different information delivery network come as a result of the climate hubs. We're going to talk about the use of social media.
So farmers are going to be tweeting and getting these old tweets. Okay, it's going to rain or not going to rain.
Well, we probably won't use tweets because you can only use 140 characters on tweet, and you notice how long it takes me to explain something.
Okay.
So 140 characters probably isn't going to do it for us, but things like more use of websites, information delivery, packaging it up, much more use of stations like this in terms of getting the radio stations to start talking about this, a number of different ways. So we're going to build new ways in which we work with people of how do we really get this information out.
Okay. Well, that's a good segue for Mr. Naylor, who is a third-generation farmer here in Iowa, and also he's been farming 30 years here in central Iowa. And I have questions, but I'm not a farmer, so I just wanted somebody who was a farmer to talk. Mr. Naylor, are you there?
Yes, I am. Yeah, thanks. I've been farming for 38 years, actually.
38 years. Okay. So,
it wouldn't hurt to have you tell us where your farm is located.
Yes, I farm near Sherdan, Iowa, in Greene County.
And the climate in Greene County, I would assume, is very similar to Story. There's not much difference in central Iowa then as far as climate patterns and so on.
No, they're very similar.
Yeah.
So,
my family's been farming here in Greene County for over 100 years, and so I heard stories from my parents and my aunts and uncles about the Dust Bowl days, the 1930s. So, and in my own farming experiencing, I can vouch for the fact that the number one constant we have out here is variability. I don't think you could actually give farmers any advice unless there was something very sure in your prediction that would actually help any, because every year is a big question mark. Farmers are gamblers every year, and the biggest problem we have is that the economic rules that we play the game by, because of lack of federal policy, in other words, we're working under policy that's referred to as a market-oriented policy. We have to think of competing with our fellow farmers in the short term. And so I'm actually, like, if I'm interested in renting land, I have to compete for that land with somebody who's willing to do what will increase their income in the short term, even though that is detrimental to the environment, pollutes our water, pollutes our air, and increases soil erosion. So while you can talk about all of the threats of climate change, the reality is that what's happening right today and what's been going on in this country for many years, especially since 1953 under this market-oriented farm policy, is a disaster as we speak. So it's a really a shame that we just have another example of our government being irresponsible and following the edicts of agribusiness. So we increase their profits and let our family farm system go down the drain along with our nitrates to the Gulf of Mexico.
Wow, that's a deep thought. I would never have put it in those words, sir. I'm glad you're here to talk with us, but I don't know where that relates to the climate change hub.
Yeah, well, if
we're going to be talking about... Dr. Hatfield, do you want to address this?
Yeah, let me talk a little bit about the aspects of managing our soil and everything else, and talk to George about some of the issues that I think are a concern for us. Because I wholeheartedly agree with you that one of the things that we have to build across the Midwest, and that's one of the things that we've talked about in our Climate Hub piece, and other things that we've written about where we're at with climate change relative to agriculture, is that we have ignored the soil base of this. And the fact that we see increased erosion from our lands because of the way in which we're managing it. We see a lot more erosion in the spring because of wetter conditions. We're going to have to adopt some new aggressive soil management practices that prevent erosion in the spring, and that's where a lot of our nitrates come from as well. So it really becomes thinking about, if we want to preserve the capabilities of agriculture to be able to produce the crops that we want, we're going to have to start with protecting the soil and water base as part of the climate piece and build our agricultural systems off of that. And eventually, yes, it may lead us to changing farm policy. There may have to be some different ways of thinking about that, but I think we've got to begin showing that this is the path we have to take to begin maintaining agriculture and building agriculture for the future.
Do you see any evidence that attitudes are beginning to change, or that people are even aware of the critical need to make these changes?
This has been an interesting piece, and until you draw this together so that people begin to understand that all of these are interconnected, then there becomes an awareness of it. But in a lot of cases, I'll be honest with you about climate and agriculture, soil and water have not been at the front of our discussion. People say, well, you know, if we can change hybrids, we'll change our cropping practice, we'll do all these different things. But in reality, we need to start with what we do to make our soil resilient to providing water when that plant needs it, preventing erosion, increasing storage, and basically going back and maintaining our soil in a way in which we can buffer some of these climate extremes that are out there.
George suggested that because of the consolidation of farming into large tracts, large corporations running the farm industry, really, that the strategy of managing the land is different. And so what you're suggesting seems to is going to run up against the short-term financial needs of these big corporations, and that seems worrisome. I don't know how we change that.
Well, there's a lot of political power behind those big corporate farms, and how would people fight against that? Or I shouldn't say fight against it. Mitigate that kind of industry, because it is capitalism at its, you know, at its best. You know, to pit things against each other to make the market low for the average consumer.
Sorry. They're seeing me sitting there scratching my head and thinking about how to answer this correctly. But but let me approach it from this way, and that is that a lot of our issues that George is talking about, if you look at what we have as a land base, and going back and using George's example, when the farm has been there for 100 years, you know, when we 100 years ago is that people owned, you know, owned all the land they worked on, and that was it. But now, across Iowa, I think we're at 60% cash rented land. Illinois is close to 70% cash rented land. So we have people that own just a small part of what they operate. And if you're paying the cash rents that, you know, are typically across the Midwest now, is that you have to look at the economic structure of that and figure out how you're going to make money. And so we have much more focus on short-term return rather than thinking about building this soil in a long base in terms of what it's going to take for the future. And to me, that's a very dangerous situation. And I write articles on that because one of the things that our capability of producing food is because of the quality of soil and the climate that we're in right now. Well, it may take that we have to change our whole thought process to maintain that just to feed the United States and ultimately to feed the world in terms of agricultural exports coming out of this area of the world. Because even if all the things that change, and we were talking about California before we went on the air, and I'll just bring that in because
they're going through a climate changing drought. I mean, they're going to change policy in California due to the drought that they're having. So if these issues affect Iowa, you know, we're not able to do the productive level of farming that we're used to, what's going to happen?
Exactly. We have an agricultural base, and if we can't produce that supports our economy, look at California right now. I mean, it's in the midst of a drought. They're moving, well, they're towards the end of their drought because they're moving into their summer pattern, which it doesn't rain anyway. I mean, it's a Mediterranean climate. It just rains from November through basically the end of March, first part of April, and then it's dry all summer. And so they're dependent, their agriculture is dependent upon what water gets stored and then applied as irrigation during the summer. Well, they don't have anything to distribute.
So they're going to be even drier. They're going to be like Texas was this last year or so.
Texas, actually, the last 4 years.
Dried up.
In parts of West Texas. I mean, so I think we're seeing all of this regional variability start occurring to us. Even in the Midwest, you know, we've seen variability over the past few years, and that's probably going to increase. George is right. I mean, one of the things that we need to know is and work on is improving the reliability of forecasts for the year. You know, how do we help producers understand that there's a good likelihood of being dry this spring, or a good likelihood of it being wet, or a good likelihood of it being normal, and putting more confidence in that so that producers can begin to work on that and around that to make some management decisions.
And so,
I was going to say, I wonder if we could ask George to jump in on the discussion, and in particular, George, I'm curious to know how you have been able to confront these pressures of competition and the need to rent land and the unpredictability of the weather and so on. How have you managed to survive over 100 years in your family?
Oh, well, by being very frugal, for one thing, and if you knew people that grew up or lived in during the Great Depression, you know, they were very frugal people, and I guess I have been too, and being a hippie from the 1960s, that helped also. But I can't say that I've ever done anything in particular in my farming practices to be sustainable or to be resilient, but one thing that I have done is not grow genetically modified crops. I've chosen not to, and that probably hasn't helped my bottom line any, but in terms of what it means to society, Roundup Ready crops in particular are a complete disaster in this free market system, because it gives some farmers the ability to farm many more acres than they used to be able to by having a big window to spray their crops so they can spray more and more acres, and that's intensified the competition among farmers for land and destroyed the biodiversity that I was familiar with when I first started farming in 1976, or when I lived here on the farm in the 1950s as a kid. The thing that we got to get back to here, though, is talking about what is your criteria for a good agriculture, and what kind of agriculture would be resilient in any kind of a climate situation. Because what we've got now is, as you can see from when you drive down the highway in Iowa, all you'll see is corn and soybeans. Those are row crops that leave the soil open for erosion, require lots of fertilizer, lots of chemicals, more and more chemicals, genetically modified crops that require more chemicals, and the chemical companies, these biotech companies, come out with even more products that are dealing with the problems that have been created by that system. And when they say that we have to have genetically modified crops to feed the world, they're saying we should be grateful to them for bringing out these technologies, when in fact, raising corn and soybeans doesn't feed the world. It feeds livestock to create meat, milk, and eggs, which only a very small percentage of the people on the planet can afford to eat. So it's all based on a lie, and really, I don't see any change coming as far as politically, unless people recognize just how disastrous this is, and realize that the environmental destruction that's happening right out their car window is as disastrous as thinking about our children living in a world without elephants or tigers or lions or polar bears.
Your point about it being a lot of it going into animal feed is relevant. I mean, what are we raising, and where is it actually headed? Because I'm a carnivore, so I'm, you know, I do like eating cow. And so I don't know.
Well, I have a question for you.
We all have to recognize that we've gone beyond our ecological limits already. And if you're going to deal with climate change, or if you're going to deal with the effects of our ways of life that we've already created, you have to have public policy. You have to change the way we live. You have to change the way we think. And currently, the most powerfully political and economic interests are telling us that we can just go full speed ahead in the direction we're going, and we can spread this way of life and this way of thinking all over the world. So now you have China producing more cars than the United States.
Okay.
And India is not far behind.
Okay. Let's get back to the climate change hub, because we asked Dr. Hatfield to come in here and talk about what he's doing, because I understand you're basically a one-man show here. You get to kind of direct the policy, and how are you going to help the farmers like George Naylor to understand these climate exchange, these extremes? Because we could talk about all this stuff, and if you really want to do that, George, we can get together and go over to the coffee shop and talk about it. And I'd like to have Dr. Hatfield talk about what he plans to do with the climate change hub. Everything that you said was spot on, George.
Cynthia, it seems to me this is a topic that we should spend more time
definitely.
On at another program, and so perhaps we could have George Naylor come back, and maybe we can get some other folks as well and explore this whole question of the economic side of farming and what, if anything,
definitely. I think you've pointed a lot of things that are very well connected.
I think we wanted to capitalize on Dr. Hatfield's availability this morning to look at one aspect of this whole project situation, which is the weather, the evolving weather, and the consequences of that,
and the extremes in weather. Yeah, yeah, big change.
Some of us older folks remember when we didn't have this cornucopia of food available every day. You know, you would go in and you would get seasonal foods as they came into season, and we may be going back to that. I guess maybe we should ask you what you
think. Yeah, Dr. Hatfield, what do you have to say?
Well, I want to go back to a comment that George made about the diversity aspects of this, and I'll link that to the climate piece of this. And this is not projection. This is things are already occurring within our signal, is that our springs are becoming a little wetter. And to the point that we've actually decreased the number of workable field days by almost 4 days in the period from April through mid-May. So in that six-week period, producers have 4 less days to get their field work done. It gets to the point that if that continues, you know, will there be a risk of getting, you know, corn and soybean planted? I think we need to be looking at more diverse rotations as part of this. But from a water utilization point of view, from a soil protection point of view, I would love to see us put more wheat back into our rotations. You know, a number of different things to look at this landscape from a different perspective than the way we're looking at it right now. Because as a agricultural state, is to not only look and say, you know, what can we do in maximizing corn bean production, but really maximizing agricultural production at a utilization of water, utilization of our sunlight energy, a number of different things. And so a lot of our research has really been about how do we use crops to capture our natural resources in the most efficient way possible, and at the same time protect that resource, protect the soil resource, build it up, a number of different things. And so when we talk about the climate hubs, it's really about, you know, you got all this variation of weather out here, but what sort of cropping system goes with that? What sort of agricultural system goes with that? To make the best use of that climate, but at the same time balance production against environmental quality. And that's why we changed the name of our lab. You mentioned that back in 2009, is to really showcase the fact that we do bridge between agriculture and environment, both in the way in which agriculture affects the environment, but also the way in which environment affects agriculture. And so we're rather unique as a laboratory doing that. And so what I'm trying to bring in a philosophy to the Climate Hub is that we need to do things differently. And we need to bring this information together to help producers understand these dynamics. I'm not going to be able to change policy because that's not part of my job, but I can provide information that hopefully will drive better policy decisions, because this is a better range of options. It's a better range based on science in terms of what we can do.
This is a good time to tell our listeners that they're listening to KHOI 89.1 Community Radio for Central Iowa, and this is the Local Talk program, and we're exploring, as we look out the window and see the snow falling, we're exploring the impact of weather on food production and what we can do about it, if anything.
Dr. Hatfield, I have a question. If if the extremes continue and farmers that plant these row crops, soybean and corn primarily, if the weather and the environment isn't predictable and these things start to fail, well, is it your suggestion that they plant other crops that are quicker, like maybe wheat or some other thing that has a few growing seasons in 1 year?
Yes. And the short answer, Cynthia, is yes, is that we need to be exploring. And I use a case study for you that we've been working on, and that is I've been working with the state of Kentucky because Kentucky grows a lot of corn. But you look at this is that the risk of summer rainfall being adequate to grow that corn crop is decreasing. So they have a lot of cases in which crop failure. And so they're looking at saying, would we be better off promoting the wheat industry, which matures earlier before the late summer droughts and everything else, to take advantage of that water, have a very economic crop out of that. And so they've built mills to process the wheat into flour and everything else. So, I mean, I think these are the types of things that we need to be exploring. If you look at our record of corn production across the state from the 1950s through 2013, we've had periods in the 50s and the 60s in which we had very little variation in corn production each year. I mean, it would continue to climb, but weather wasn't a major impact. We went through the 70s, there was a lot of impact in weather. We went back through a quiet period, and now we're coming back. There's a lot of variation. Well, if we think about the price of seed, the price of inputs, you know, will those crops remain profitable? And will there be a change just because of the profitability factor that people will start exploring? I mean, you look at another case example is that we've seen a rapid expansion of corn and soybean production in North Dakota and South Dakota in the past 10 years. And you talk about the migration. Well, here's been a migration, and those two crops have replaced wheat and sunflower and canola. And I show there's five reasons for that. One is it's a little longer growing season because it's warm. There's been a little bit more rainfall. Widespread adoption of conservation tillage, so they take advantage of every bit of water that falls. They have relatively low cash rents, so you don't have to produce 200-plus bushel corn to recover all your production cost, and the high price of corn and soybeans. And so we've seen this rapid expansion in a crop production area that typically wasn't there. Well, if a hiccup in climate occurs, so it becomes a little drier, a little more erratic, that'll all be back east of the Missouri River again. And so we see these things moving back and forth. And so, you know, in the Corn Belt, because our climate is relatively stable in terms of what it takes to grow those crops, you know, we'll see subtle changes and differences. But I think we're going to have to look at this whole region and saying one of our issues is, and coming back to a point of erosion, one of our issues is the environmental impact of production, and how do we look at bringing climate along with our production system to look at the environmental quality issue.
I wanted to ask George
said, that was actually very good.
Yeah,
thank
very,
you, sir.
I wanted to ask George George had mentioned something in his conversation about growing crops that are not genetically modified, and I know that there's a growing demand among consumers for products that are not genetically modified. And I'm wondering if that is paying off for you, George, and are you able to get a little more return for some of the crops that you're growing?
Yes, I've been able to get some premiums for raising non-GMO corn and soybeans. It hasn't made much of a difference. For corn especially, it's only generally around 50 cents a bushel, and usually I have to haul it 60 or 100 miles away, so most of the premium gets eaten up by transportation.
So this is
but then I've looked at changing my crop rotation or adding crops to my rotation. But let me point out the difficulty in adding wheat to your rotation. For one thing, wheat doesn't grow on every kind of soil, and even oats, we used to have oats on the farm. small grains tend to be vulnerable to diseases like rust. If you get the wrong kind of weather at the wrong kind of time, you may get a disastrous crop. Besides that, you might only get about 60 bushel to the acre. And so 60 times, let's say, $6 a bushel is $360. Well, you would not be able to compete at all in terms of cash rent if you thought that you were going to pay the cash rent for land around here and raise a crop of wheat. You wouldn't even have enough money to pay the cash rent. So you can wipe that off the charts as far as your options here as a farmer in Iowa. And how to bring cattle back onto the land so I could grow, so I could be organic. And it's a huge change, and it takes a leap of faith actually to do that kind of a change. But unless there's federal policy to make it so that a farmer can make those kind of changes without risking their livelihood, yeah, that's not going to happen.
George, I have a question. Do you think that there is a farm bubble with the land prices happening here in Iowa? Or just in the Midwest?
Undoubtedly. I've seen it happen before in the 1970s. You have to realize that the price bubble we've had in grain resembles the price bubble that we had in the 1970s that resulted because of the federal monetary policy that happened after Nixon cut the dollar off from gold and allowed the Federal Reserve to bail the economy out by printing money at that time. That's the same thing's happened today. And if you'll read economists' explanations of what's happened in recent times, increases in commodity prices, in land, in metals, in gold, are all a response to that. And eventually that will come to an end. Interest rates will go up. And the farm economy will be depressed, and land prices will collapse. So, yeah, we got a bubble in it, and it. The thing that you have to realize is that when the farmers that are existing today go broke or throw in the towel, you won't end up with more smaller farms. You'll end up with even bigger farms. We'll be heading to a state where as the farmers in Europe refer to as farming without farmers.
So it'll be like these big agro businesses. What you're saying is that after this bubble breaks, that the only farmers that will be left are big agro business.
Yes, there'll be the ability to finance these huge farms. I mean, just look at our livestock now. There are almost no independent hog producers anymore. The hogs are owned by the packing companies or other aggregators in between, and you can't expect farmers to have the financing and the ability to underwrite the kind of risk that we're facing. And anyway, as I said, the environmental degradation that's going on as we exist, if you define how we're going to change agriculture so that, or change farmers' practices so they can just raise more feed grains and oil seeds like corn and soybeans, then you're missing the whole point. So, for instance, also let me point out that with the genetically modified crops, you'll hear Monsanto and Bayer and Dow talk about how they're coming out with genetically modified corn that will resist drought. Well, you think, oh, that's really going to be good for Iowa farmers. But the fact of the matter is, they even have maps on their websites that shows how this will lead to corn production out in arid parts of the United States and arid parts of the world, so that there will be more soil erosion, more pollution, to raise more corn to feed livestock that, as I said, will only feed a very small percentage of the people on the planet.
So these are big industrial things that go to mass market, you know, like, you know, other industries then. But what you're talking about, and the point I think that I hear underneath all this, George, Mr. Naylor, is that small farmers, organic producers who have the practices of soil conservation and, you know, just sustaining the land, those aren't being helped by the government. Dr. Fatfield, what would you say to that? How would you? What's your policy? You know, what's your policy? I mean, you spent your life with doing soil research and plant crop. You know, using the best practices in using scientific methods to get the best practices for this. What advice do you have? I mean, because George seems very passionate about it, and he has a certain philosophy, but what do you want to contribute to this conversation?
Well, let me come back and talk about a couple points in this thing, and that is that our soil resource is still the basis of agriculture, and that I, too, worry about our degradation of our soil resource, because one of the things that we've seen in a multi-state analysis is that the average corn and soybean yields are a direct function of the quality of the soil. So low county yields are associated with poor quality soils in that county. And the other thing we see is as we degrade our soil, we have less capability of producing that crop that's there. And so if we continue to degrade our soil resource, our capability of producing that profitable crop diminishes. And so we're going to have to, I think, become very aggressive in looking at how do we improve our soil, how do we improve its water-holding capacity, how do we improve its organic matter, how do we improve its biological component so that it does restore itself, because we'll be better off from a production point of view because we'll find that crops are more resistant to the variation of weather that's out there, all these different things. And I think we have to be very careful in talking about, and I'll just use drought-tolerant corn as an example, because in order to produce that crop, the crop requires water. You don't grow a crop on zero water. And I think, let me dispel a myth that's out there on drought-resistant corn, is I think the perception is that we can grow this crop without any water. And there's a linear relationship between the amount of water that a crop uses and its productivity level. And I tell producers that if you want to grow 300 bushel corn from where we're at today, it's going to take 5 more inches of water transpired by that crop. And if it doesn't rain, that means that's going to come out of the soil. We have to increase the capability of the soil of holding that 5 inches more. And if we, the drought-resistant corn has a different way of responding to that, but it still takes water to grow it. So it's really, when we talk about a lot of these issues with climate and agriculture, it really comes back down to soil and water as the two primary things that are the key piece of building this crop. And, you know, if we destroy our soil resource or we limit the amount of water that's available to that, no matter what we do in terms of everything else, we're limited in terms of what we can grow.
So even though the plant may be able to survive a little bit, it won't be a producer.
That's right. It may survive, but it may not produce you a grain crop.
Wow.
Could I ask if you think, Dr. Hatfield, that the trend in Iowa is for less moisture?
Actually, the trend in Iowa is actually not for, it's actually a slight increase in precipitation, but here's what's occurring as part of that signal. And if you look at some of our projections, is that wetter springs, hotter and drier summers, there's a change in distribution. There's a change in the frequency of the rainfall events, so they're less frequent and they're more intense. And with more intense rainfalls, we need to have that soil protected to prevent erosion under that condition. You know, if it occurs more in the spring and we don't have that soil in a condition to hold that water, it just runs off or leaches down through, so it's not available for that plant later on in the growing season. So that's why I come back and focus on the fact that soil is such a part of understanding climate and agriculture.
Well, I know the history shows in parts of the world that are now pretty dry, there were times when there were terraces and other water-containing systems built. I don't think we've needed to do that in Iowa, are you thinking that something like that might be necessary in the future?
I think so. I think we really need to focus on, and an aspect that we've been working on is how do we improve the organic matter content of soil? You know, what's it take to improve that water holding capacity? You know, and I think we may have to think about some of the water conserving techniques that a lot of people use in areas that have more limited rainfall. And you think about the rows of corn out there, but actually have units after that corn is planted that actually create little dikes every couple feet, so any water that falls doesn't run down the furrow. It just kind of settles as little ponds. And then they go through and knock those down before they harvest or anything else. So, you know, I think those are things we have to think about, water conserving techniques. And you know, that's kind of bizarre to think about an area that we often think about spring flooding and we think about too much water, to think about what do I do for water conserving techniques as part of my farming operation. But we may get to that point of thinking about how do we manage this system differently. And I really think that we need to have a much broader perspective on how agriculture fits in the environment and what environment is doing out there, to say what's the best thing we can do to help producers like George and everybody else across there understand here's what's occurring and here's the type of information and the types of practices that could go with that to make it profitable for them.
Is that your goal with the Climate Hub? To get this information out to the farmers?
Oh, yes. That's the primary purpose of the hubs, is really to take science information and put it into information-based decision-making. Now, we're not going to make the decisions. We're going to provide that information to producers so they can make better decisions or understand some of the dynamics that are going on.
So how? What kind of recommendations would you have right now, besides just the soil and the water, which are big things, but I mean, how can people build up their soil?
They can build up their soil by maintaining residue, reducing tillage, getting that organic matter put back into that soil, letting the soil biology begin to decompose that, a little bit like your garden.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of
compost,
you know,
it's all about the compost.
It's really about the compost, but letting the biology in that soil build that compost up. We see some tremendous things that are changing soil very rapidly in this. So it's those practices, I think, if we want to buffer against some of these short-term stresses that...
So create the soil as a very living thing.
Yep.
That will absorb a lot of water and retain it.
And cycle nutrients for the plant and everything else.
Wow. So, you know, it sounds good, but, you know, how profitable is that for the row crop farmer?
Actually, it increases their profitability a lot, because what we've seen in a lot of our analysis is that 20% of their potential yield is lost 80% of the time, which occurs because of short-term stresses during the growing season. And by short-term stresses, what I mean is that we may have needed an inch of rainfall for adequate water, but we only got a half inch during a rainfall event. If we'd had a little bit more storage capacity in that soil, we could have buffered that. And so where we see in improving our soil is we tend to take those little pieces of the puzzle out and begin to help improve that. So the difference between a profitable and a non-profitable crop often is one rainfall. And so if you could think about managing that soil to hold that one rainfall worth of water, then you would have a lot of impact in terms of production.
So when you say not tilling, what do you mean by that? I mean, not mixing up the soil and not just describe some of that to me.
When I talk about conservation tillage, it's really about maintaining that residue on the surface, doing very small amounts of tillage. We do a lot of strip till work in which we just create a zone in which we put the seed down and nothing else is disturbed across that. So you see a lot of residue left on that field.
So the corn stalks are left there.
And it
looks kind of yucky, actually. It's not as tidy as plowing everything under.
Yeah, to you it's not tidy. To me, it's the way we ought to look at it. I'll give you an example from 2 weeks ago when we had that little snow event that was more in the northern part of the state. I drove back and forth to Dubuque, and it snowed in the morning a little bit like this. And then in the afternoon, the wind was blowing about 40 miles an hour, and I was driving along Highway 20. And any time that there was a field with corn residue in the standing stalks, there was no snow across Highway 20. The road was completely bare and dry. But as soon as you went into a field that had been tilled and there was no way to capture that snow, the road was all snow-covered. So that's how effective it is in capturing snow out there.
Well, it's also, it costs money to till the soil like that.
Sure.
So they're burning up their profits by tilling the soil.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, I think you, Cynthia, you mentioned one of the big concerns that some farmers have is that their farms look messy,
yeah.
And therefore they don't want to leave it like that. It doesn't. Then I can't be proud of that. But if you continue with the Agricultural Hub program, you're hoping you can convince more farmers that this is one of the steps they can take.
That's one of the steps they can take. It really is, when we think about all this information, there is a great deal of information that needs to be brought together and put into a whole systems approach to help producers. It isn't really just saying, well, let's focus just on the soil, or let's focus on not doing tillage, or let's focus on this particular cropping practice, but really bringing all that together and putting it around this umbrella of what's happening in the climate. So it really is a very holistic approach to agriculture.
Does that, Dr. Hatfield, does that make you like a librarian of all this knowledge? I mean, that's like going to the library and you're checking out information. You're going, what do I need to do to do the best I can?
Yeah, when it really is, and that's a good way to think about it, is, and when we talk about science-based information delivery and all of this, it's really about cataloging information and synthesizing that information and putting the probability estimates on it to help producers, but also to understand what agriculture is doing. And one of the critical pieces of the Climate Hub that I want to make sure that people know about is the fact that we're not doing this in an isolation in an office. Is that one of the critical pieces of the Climate Hubs will be our stakeholders, in which we're going to be working with the producers, we're going to be working with agribusiness, a number of different ones, so that we get their input as to what they want. We're not going to build it and say, well, gee, this is what you want. If we're going to ask them what they're going to want, and then we're going to build it along the way.
Right.
So are you going to have any opportunities for farmers to come and talk with you?
Oh, yes. We're going to be having all sorts of stakeholder meetings rolling out in March here. We're going to have webinars. We're going to have a number of different things. We're going to try to get some of that before they hit into the spring planning.
Oh,
so
definitely.
We can start bringing this together.
Once that spring planting, the farmers are going to be way too busy. Right now, it's a snowy day. They probably have time to hang out.
Have a chat with me.
Yeah, very much so. I'm sure there's a lot of gentlemen and ladies out there that would really like to have a few things to say. But
Cynthia, we can put his website on our website so that people could contact him.
Yeah, but we have run out of time, and you've been listening to Local Talk, where we explore the people, stories, and events here in Central Iowa. And I would like to thank our guest today, Dr. Jerry Hatfield at the USDA.
National Laboratory for Agriculture and the Environment.
Yes, and he is basically our climate change hub guy. He is the librarian of knowledge and information. So thank you, Dr. Hatfield. I really appreciate you coming. And Mr. George Naylor, who is a farmer and has a very passionate view about everything. Thank you, George, for talking with us today. And
you're very welcome. Thank you.
And Jerry Hatfield, I'm going to put out his phone number and his email address. Please be civil. He's a very nice person. His phone number is 515-294-5723. That's 515-294-5723, and he is our climate change hub.
And we'll have that on the website.
Yeah, we'll have that on the website. And he can be reached at jerry.hatfield@ars.usda.gov. He is a plant physiologist?
Physiologist, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you would like to join our team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878, or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and check us out on Facebook. You can also listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. Your participation as an audience and your generous donation help make KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.